Hi, my name is Yvonne Diaz. I am 35 years old. My pronouns are she, her, ella, and today's date is January 28, 2023. We're in El Paso, Texas, and I'm here with my coworker, Sophia.
Hi, my name is Sophia Vantmier. I am 22 years old. It is January 28th, 2023, and I'm here in El Paso, Texas with Yvonne, my coworker and colleague.
Awesome. So we can start with like one of the first questions that we have prepared. We can start by describing like our roles. What do we do? Where do we work?
Okay. So I work for Texas Rising. I am the advocacy and field organizer. And my job is to organize events for our chapter citywide. We do a lot of advocacy for different issues, specifically immigration reform, environmentalism, reproductive justice, and things like that. So we do rallies around town. We collab with other organizations to work on getting a community supportive of each other on these issues. So that's my duty. Yvonne, what do you do for our organization?
I feel like we do a lot on a lot of different issues. So I'm the regional field coordinator for or organizer. I don't know my title. We manage like the region, coordinate to collaborate with other organizations. We work with campus organizer Michael, and we try to advocate for the different issues that a lot of young people care about, like immigration reform, as you said, climate justice, reproductive or abortion rights, and just like those issues that are so important that can be a lot in debate, but I think it's super important that we look into them and explore and see what we can do to make our communities better.
So, what led you to community organizing and activism?
For me, I think we talked about this. I felt like I was more like I had to do it, not forced, but I felt like it was something that I needed to do if I wanted to really have an active role on the decisions about my future and my life. I graduated from here from UTIP with a philosophy degree and psychology degree, and I started working at a mental health clinic here, and then in San Antonio, I had like a background on mental health, caseworker, and I saw that a lot of the times, the system is difficult for people, including it doesn't matter if you're a citizen or you're not a citizen, if you have money or don't have money, the system usually works more around of the people that has money. So I wanted to take a look into how I can have more an active role for to advocate for people and for myself because I'm also a DACA recipient. I came here when I was young, and a lot of the decisions that were made in the government and especially after 2016 were affecting me. And that's when I decided to switch roles, and I started working for political candidates that I thought that were going to create a change. It was harder than what I thought, but that's how I started. I started working for different political candidates in the state, Congress, that were running for Congress, that were running for Senate, even some presidential campaign, and I went to different states. And I started trying to have those officials elected, the ones that I thought that could make a change. And then a year and a half, my dad had an accident. He fell off the roof, and that's when I came back to El Paso because he has cancer, and I thought that everyone thought that he was not gonna make it, and or he had like very little time, but it's been a year and a half and he's still alive. But that's what brought me to El Paso, and that's when I started getting more deep into organizing and advocating and just working with Texas Rising has been kind of like a stepping stone and has helped me getting to know like the ways of advocacy. How can I continue advocating for myself, for my community, or for the issues that a lot of us care about? And what about you?
So for me, I'm fortunate enough to not have to worry about a lot of the things you were describing. I was born here, but my parents, my mom wasn't. My mom was born in Mexico, so I always, you know, even though I'm not an immigrant, I'm first generation, but I always understood a lot of her struggles. I grew up with them, and she's naturalized now, mm-hmm. but for most of my childhood, she wasn't, and I remember, like, thinking, when she did become naturalized, like, I was not any more proud of her for becoming a citizen mm-hmm. than I would have been if she wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, like, I just don't, it's, growing up, I grew up in Boston, my family is from Juarez and here, and some in Cruces, mm-hmm. but I grew up in Boston. My parents moved there, so I grew up there. So I grew up in a very predominantly white community. It was a working class Irish neighborhood that I lived in. So when we moved there, we were literally like the only Mexicans in the neighborhood. These people had never seen a Latino in their life. Like it was, you know, like they thought like I was. They'd be like, "Oh, you're Spanish," and like you. Then as a little kid, it's this really awkward position of, like, having to explain to people that's a different thing. Mm-hmm. Like, Spanish, that's in, like, Europe, that's not, we're Mexican, like, that's a totally different thing. And even as Latinos, like, you know, the few other immigrants that were there, you know, being Latino is not, like, a universal experience, you know? Mm-hmm. So, growing up there, there's no sense of, I guess, respect in that sense, you know, because most of those families have been there for hundreds of years, and they were not used to this, like, Mexican family they'd been exposed to. But it was really funny, though, because I don't think I experienced racism, like, in the more obvious sense. As a Mexican family, I went to a Catholic school, mm-hmm. and like many Mexicans, I have a Catholic family, and that community was an Irish Catholic community. So I think that, you know, Catholicism was kind of a way for them to accept us. They were, like, very standoffish at first. And they found out we were Catholic. So they were very welcoming. And the parents of my friends were able to find community in that sense. And they were very welcoming. And everybody I grew up with they were very nice people. Like, I'm not going to say, like, oh, I'm a victim of racism. Like, all these people were horrible to me. My family were the only Mexican. It wasn't like that. They were very nice, welcoming people. But inevitably, when you're in a community like that, that it's not exposed to your people, there were just little things that you notice the older you get, like microaggressions. And I know they're not mean people. They're not bigoted people. But as you get older, you notice things that, like, are kind of inappropriate. And when you're little, like, you don't think much of it because it's not really your job to evaluate the socio-political state of your role in the community, you know, the community or your role in it, where your sense of identity in that place. But, yeah, it's just looking back on it, you notice things. You're like, that was racism.
Do you think, like, growing up in that environment kind of shaped, like, your views, like, now that you're older, how do you think that also influenced for you to do the job that we do, like, here in the community, like, just, like, being self-aware of the environment that you were in?
Yeah, so, like I said, we were the only Mexicans, so I was hyper-aware of that from a young age, because people pointed it out, not because I was, like, particularly, like, worried about it or anything, but when you're the only brown girl in a class of, like, 30 Irish kids, like, they're gonna know, right? So they were very quick to otherize, and I'm not gonna say experienced, like, bullying. It wasn't like that, but it was just, it's little comments, like, for example, I don't know if this is a universal experience, but in school, we got crayons, and it was, like, the cheap pack of, like, 8 crayons, like, the primary colors, and, like, black and brown. So, like, race was, like, super, they point it out when you're young. Like, things that I was never, like, had to think about, the other kids were quick to point out, because the white kids usually use, like, when drawing themselves, they would use, like, a yellow crayon. That was the crayon most similar to their skin tone out of, like, the, you know, the primary colors. They would use a yellow crayon. The black kids would usually use a brown crayon. And then, so as a brown girl, I would do this funny thing. I would kind of mix, like, the yellow and the brown crayon to kind of create, like, an in-between color. And then, yeah, I remember one time, like, reaching for, like, the yellow crayon to kind of make this in-between shade. And then this kid, he goes, like, oh, like, you can't use that. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, like, that's, like, for, you know, like, white kids. Like, you can't use that color. Like, use the brown one. And I was like, but I'm not really that dark either. Like, I'm trying to create, like, an in-between shade. And he was telling me, he was like, well, you're, like, black, so use, like, the black crayon. And I was like, see, I know what black is. I know I'm not white, but I know I'm not black either. Like, being brown is kind of, like, a separate thing. And he couldn't fathom that, like, you know, like, to him, the way he, like, it was, like, there was the white kids, and then there was, like, everybody else. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, like, you're not light enough to use, like, the yellow crayon. Like, use the black one, like, the black kids. And it's like, why are you being so weird about it? Like, I was just a little girl, like, trying to create, like, this, like, shade of brown that suited me. And he was really quick to point out, like, I was too dark to use the yellow crayon or whatever. And, like, at the time, it didn't bother me. I was like, okay, dude, like, whatever you say. Like, I was just going to keep doing what I was doing. But as I got older, I was like, that's so weird. Like, why does this kid feel the need to point out, like, you can't use this crayon? Like, it's not that serious. Like, you don't need to, you know? So it's things like that. Like, it wasn't anything brutal. It wasn't anything that, like, traumatized me. But, like, you notice things as you get older that are like, you know what? Like, that's not nice. That's not normal. Like, mm-hmm. You know? So I forgot where I was going with it. There's a point to that. I remember. So, yeah, so that was my experience in school, like, being the only Mexican there. So, like, I was hyper aware of race at a very young age for, like, no reason. Because my parents, like, at home, we always spoke Spanish because, obviously, you know, in Boston, it's not like we were going to be speaking Spanish at school. So at home, we only spoke Spanish, so they made sure that my siblings and I wouldn't lose it. But they never really gave me, like, a huge lecture, like, oh, like, you're Mexican, like, you need to know. They never gave me, like, a huge history lesson. Like, it was pretty, they never made a big deal out of the fact that, like, we were the only Mexican family. Like, obviously, they had, like, Mexican pride, or Latino pride, or Chicano pride, but it was never, like, a huge issue that they imposed on me when I was little. They just kind of let me, like, figure it out along the way. It was other kids that made me, like, hyper aware of the fact that I was brown or whatever. So that's one thing. But growing up, also, I lived in this, like, condo complex, and my neighbors, they were lesbians. They were a lesbian couple, and they were super nice, and they were, when my brother and I, we were in elementary school, and they would often invite us up. They were gardeners. They had a beautiful garden. They would grow flowers and, like, fresh vegetables, and they would often, like, have us up there and help them, like, cook or garden, or just, you know, they were a really nice, like, lovely couple. So that's, I bring that up because I had kind of a similar experience with, like, the LGBT community. Like, growing up, I was exposed to it. I never saw it as, like, you know, a polarizing issue. I always, like, and I remember I was a flower girl at their wedding, actually. Oh. And so, like, when I was a kid, like, there was no moment where I was like, Mom, Dad, like, why do these two women get married? Like, I thought it had to be a boy and a girl. It was never anything like that. Like, my parents never explained it to me. They never were like, hey, Sophia, like, we need to talk to you. So, you know, our neighbors, like, they're together. Like, it was never anything like that. Like, they never really acknowledged it because it wasn't something that they saw as needing to be acknowledged. Like, no, like, they were a couple. I knew that they were a couple. And, like, I never really had questions about it. It was never really seen as, like, shocking. So I'm really fortunate that my parents kind of, like, had me in an environment where they did not need to point out or, like, you know, otherwise marginalized communities. It was something that I was used to. I mentioned how we were the only Latino family, like, in the neighborhood, but we were not the only immigrant neighborhood. I mean, an immigrant family. My particular street, we had a lot of Vietnamese and Haitian and Jamaican immigrants. Mm-hmm. So although we were definitely, like, the only Latinos, like, there was also that kind of sense of, you know, immigrant community that I found in that neighborhood. I was at Dorchester. So Dorchester is, like, historically a super working-class Irish neighborhood, but because it was working-class, a lot of immigrants moved there. So despite being, like, in a very white area, we were also able to find community with other immigrants in that sense. So I bring all this up. I know I'm, like, going off on, like, separate tangents, but I bring all this up because I think the point is these, like, I guess, identities that are seen as political right now are, or I mean, I guess have always been political. The point is, like, these things that are, like, controversial. Growing up, I was fortunate enough to grow up in an environment where it wasn't. It was normal to me. And then you get older and then you realize, oh, people don't like gay people. People don't like women. People don't like Mexicans or Black people. Like, why? Like, that's so weird because that's all I've known. Even though I've never had, like, one experience that was, like, so traumatic that I thought, oh, I need to, like, fight for my community. Mm-hmm. No, I think it was always kind of ingrained in because it was always normal. It was always normal to me. And then I found out a lot of people don't view it as normal. Mm-hmm. Like, huh, that's curious. Like, maybe we should do something about that.
I would probably say that maybe it's just a small people that don't like those things. I think the majority of us, like, we have been more accepting. We have been more, I don't know, people say woke, even though I don't really like that. But I think it goes back to the work that we do, that a lot of people are not just politically engaged.
And that's so true.
The presentation last week at the university, and one of the questions that we ask is how many people are into politics? And it was at one point zero hands in a classroom of over 30 people. And then the other one, it was about two hands or three hands, no more than that. But then when we ask about who cares about the issues for criminal justice reform or for climate justice or for reproductive rights, then we see a lot more people raising their hands. I think it's just that a lot of people are not engaged in the political world.
Well, I think you're right. I think the problem is that they don't realize that so many of these issues are political. Even though they shouldn't be, a lot of things we think should be a given, they're political. And so I think that's a problem, is people are, like, not informed of the fact that, you know, you might be like, oh, no, politics, that's not my thing, like, it's none of my business. But it is. People don't realize, like, things that you might not even realize are political. Mm-hmm. Like, anything that affects you on the day-to-day, it's political. And so I think people don't really advertise. They think, oh, like, political, that's, you know, Congress people and politicians and mayors and the Senate, that's none of my business. Like, well, it is. Like, there's city council, there are things that affect you on the day-to-day, and we don't advertise as a community the fact that all these issues, they are political and they do affect you enough, you know. And so I think it's easy for a lot of people to be like, oh, you know, these people, like, they're just ignorant, they don't want to be. I think a lot of people, like, in my experience, they can be very judgmental of people who say things like that, like, oh, no, like, I don't know. And I think it's unfair because I think a lot of people just don't know, like, these issues are political.
I mean,
and many
that's
things.
Why I got involved in politics or organizing world in contrast, like, with you. You were more like, probably, okay, this is important, like, you realized in your own, like, even if it wasn't affecting you in other ways or directly, but your upbringing kind of influenced that. And for me, it was, like, the opposite. Like, I would have probably been, like, happy. I got my DACA when I was 25 after graduating from college. And I was like, okay, cool, I can get my master's now, and I can continue just doing life like normal people do. But mm-hmm. then it started, like, my freedom or my privilege to be in this country was threatened, and that's when I was like, okay, I need to leave everything aside and just get involved and do whatever I can. And I think that's the majority of people, like, we don't get involved until it affects us sometimes. Yeah. And even if it affects us, we don't realize maybe how can we get involved. And I think definitely that's how or why I started getting involved, because it was affecting me. I thought that after getting DACA, maybe things were going to change. After, I don't know, Obama was president, things were going in a better way. But then in 2016, like, we know everything, like, kind of went downhill for a lot of people. And as I said, like, if it affects us, then we get to work. But if it doesn't affect us, maybe it doesn't really. It's really hard to get involved. But for you, like, if maybe you were not directly affected, but, like, your upbringing was definitely an influence for you to get in this line of work.
Yeah. And then that's not to say I was completely, like, unaffected. Like, I wouldn't say I'm a victim. But, you know, growing up, like, you know, say, like, as a Mexican, as a woman, you notice things. You're like, yo, you know what, that is bigotry, that is misogyny, that was racism. And, you know, if you're, like, you know, 5-year-old, you may not really pick up on what it is or why. But as you get older, you're like, oh, like, yeah, people don't like me because of how I look, you know? Like, it's funny, but, yeah, like, I definitely think it's really cool how, I know you say, like, you got into it because you felt like you had no choice. But that's not necessarily true. Like, I really admire the fact that you were able to be engaged, like, knowing the risks, because I do know people that they were in similar positions as you, but they choose to, like, lay low, and I get that, like, no disrespect to them, like, I totally understand. So I think it's really admirable that, you know, knowing, like, the risks, you still choose to get out there and fight for your rights.
I think you just said, like, the key word, like, sometimes it feels like privilege, like, we do also things maybe out of, like, need, but also realizing, like, the privilege, because I do realize that sometimes, like, other people doesn't feel like they have the privilege to do that. Maybe I'm not in a privileged position, but I try to do it also because I know maybe education is a privilege, and I know I'm aware of, like, what are my rights, what are my well, the things that I can respond to in case that any, I don't know if it's making sense, but the things that I can respond to or the ways that I can respond to certain situations, and also, like, money definitely is a privilege, like, having, and I'm not saying, I definitely don't have money or anything, but I know I had, like, been in a better position too, like, when I started working in San Antonio, or just have meeting a lot of people, you network and you start earning more money. So I know that some people might not go to a rally, not because they don't want to, but maybe because they have to work. And if you don't work, you don't eat. And I think that's the privilege I have. I have the privilege to be working in an organization, Texas Rising, that focuses on advocating and provides the right tools, provides the funding for us to do things like this, and that's definitely a privilege, and having the knowledge and the information about what are my rights, what are the things that I can or cannot do, even when I have, like, DACA. So that's definitely privilege. Would you consider, like, maybe there are things that you feel like you have privilege that allows you to do this kind of work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I am a citizen. Both my parents are citizens now, but I still have family that isn't, and they know the work that I do, and they're very supportive, but they won't attend a lot of the stuff out of, like, the rallies that we do or things that we do out of fear, because it's not just, like, risk of, like, getting deported or things like that, but also, like, there are reporters there, like, they don't want their picture taken, or I have friends that they live in environments where they don't feel totally safe, like, for example, I have gay friends that maybe, like, aren't out to their parents, so they can't go to, you know, certain rallies, because if their parents find out, you know, they'll get disowned. So out of their own safety, they can't do the things that they want to do. Same thing with some of my friends that would like to go to abortion rallies. They have very conservative parents that are super against that. So they just say, like, I can't go. Like, I would love to go, but I can't, because if they take my picture and my mom finds out, like, I'll be homeless. So I'm really lucky that I grew up, I have educated parents that are very, like, open-minded, and they are very supportive of the work that I do. And I don't live with them anymore, so I also don't have to worry, since I'm not dependent on them. You, like, if they weren't open-minded, I still wouldn't have to worry about coming home to people that aren't supportive of what I do or are going to disown me because of what I do, because I'm fortunate enough to have been able to move out. But I know a lot of people in the community who aren't able to do that. Most of my friends still can't afford to move out of their parents' house. So they, you know, you're like, my house, my rules. Like, they still have to abide by whatever their parents
I still live with are. My parents, and I'm 35 years old.
Yeah, like, and it's like that for most people here, I think. Like,
yes,
to
get,
like,
I was gonna say
a big, like, salary job, like, you're not gonna move out till you're, like, in your 30s, maybe.
It's probably, like, a Hispanic, like, or Latinx, whichever term is preferred. I think it's, like, cultural, and especially here in El Paso. Yeah. And also economical. Like, I know that I'm with my parents because we, like, when my dad got sick, we started, like, supporting each other. And it's also, like, cultural. I feel like that we here in El Paso, we all, like, depend a lot on that. But that it's also, as you said, like, it can have its pros and cons. And when it comes to advocacy or, like, doing things that you care and organizing, that cannot be to the best of our advantage at times. Since we're talking about this, what would you consider to be, like, some of the risks of working in this line of work, in advocacy and organizing?
Oh, that's a good question.
I know that for me is, like, self-care. I know that a lot of the times we work a lot because we're passionate, because we like what we do.
And since it's never ending, you don't take a break as much as you need to, because it never ends. There's always
there's always
work to be done.
Yes, and not having boundaries and not being able to draw the line, that is definitely some of the things that can affect us in this line of work. Like, it can be too. There's a lot of emotional investment.
Yeah, definitely.
We're working on a Saturday right now.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. Like, we're lucky that we get to, you know, do work that we like. But there's this quote, and it's like, yeah, like, if you don't work a 9-to-5, you're going to work 7 days a week. It's kind of true. Like, in my experience, like, our work, since we do different things every day, you never really know what your schedule's going to look like. We do work almost every day, and we don't have a lot of boundaries that, I guess, people, like, who have, like, 9-to-5s would, you know, not that they necessarily always have the best boundaries either. I know. Plenty of people work 9-to-5s that still are, like, taken advantage of. But, you know, in theory, you're supposed to be off the clock after 5 on a Friday. For us, like, we don't have that. So it's also, like, the luxury of not, like, knowing what your schedule is going to be like, because there's always something. Like, you might be like, oh, like, I'm going to work in the morning, you know, Monday through Thursday, and then I'll be off, and then, oh, like, a surprise rally is happening on Saturday. You're like, well, like, I should go. And so even though, like, you didn't really work it into your schedule, you still go because it's something that you care about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, it's great. Like, you love that. But over time, like, if you're doing stuff like that, like, almost every week or several times a month, you can get burnt out really quickly. And so I think you're right. It's important that we learn to take better care of ourselves and set those, like, work-life balances. But it's just so hard because our work is about our lives. So it's really, there's, like, a really kind of
How do you think we can change that? Or how do you think we can work on that? Because I need the advice there.
I mean, I don't think this is, like, super profound or helpful, but I think communication has to be the number one. You have to be, also just have the nerve, like, I guess, to tell your boss, like, I'm gonna be unavailable, like, Friday. Like, I'm not, like, requesting time off. Like, I'm telling you, I'm not going to be there. So, like, figure it out, because, like, I can't be there.
But I've never heard you say that.
No, I say it. I just say it nicer than that.
Being able to say no, that's definitely...
But, yeah, you have to learn to say no, and, like, it doesn't have to just be no. You just have to be able to stand up to your boss in whatever manner is appropriate at the time. For me, I'm really lucky, because you're my boss. So... I'm really lucky that I have a boss that I get along with, and we work together really well, and, you know, we're not, like, afraid of each other. Mm-hmm. But that's not always the case. You know, I feel like for most people, they don't have that kind of employer-employee relationship. Because I genuinely see you more as, like, a colleague, because you've treated me with the respect that a colleague would.
We believe in decentralization.
Yeah. Like, it's different from, like, the boss. So I've never been afraid to tell you, like, hey, Yvonne, like, I'm sorry, but, like, I can't do this. Like, I'm at capacity right now. I can reschedule for this day. But, like, at that time, it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm lucky that I work in this environment. And I think we work with a lot of people that are like that.
Understanding.
We work with a lot of really understanding and kind and smart and patient people. So I've never had, like, any major issues like that at this job. But I definitely had in this, like, realm. I've definitely worked with other... you know, people that are very just inconsiderate of, you know, boundaries. And I told them, like, I'm an employee. Like, I'm replaceable. Like, I'm not going to break my back for $10 an hour. Like, it's not worth it. So it's just, it's also, it's like kind of having to work up the nerve not to just tell people no, but also to just kind of stand up
for yourself
in any capacity.
You advocate for the community, but sometimes we don't advocate for ourselves. And I think that's something that I feel that even if I have really understanding, like, supervisors, manager, I think sometimes I ask too much from myself and I push myself to the limits. And I think that's also part of, like, an immigrant trauma.
That's definitely cultural. I think,
I feel like I have to continuously validate myself because my worth, sometimes I see it, like, reflected as the level of productivity that I have. I am worthy of remaining on this country because of the work that I do, because of how...
Because of what you produce.
Yes, and it shouldn't be like that because I feel like everyone... including immigrants, including everyone, we should and we deserve rest.
No, like, you do.
Everyone deserves to rest and have time for themselves. And
regardless of your productivity levels. And I see that a lot in my mom, too. She's the first one over. And I see that in her, definitely. She definitely, I think, in that sense, kind of feels like, no, like, they let me in. I have to... go above and beyond. And I'm like, Mom, that's great, I'm proud of you, but, you know, your boss, they're taking advantage of you. Like, you're working like 60 hours. Like, you're not getting paid to do this. Like, I promise you, you can tell people no. But there's stuff, and I think that's a very, like, universal immigrant experience in the U.S. But it's also kind of a Latino thing. I've noticed, like, because even if you're not, like, I get that in my family, even those of us that are, like, citizens, there's also that sense of, like, I don't know if it's, like, Chicano pride or it's, like, you know, white people, they're never going to see you as one of them. So you always have something to prove. You have to work two or three times as hard to get half of what they get. So whatever you do, it's never going to be enough. So you can never stop. You cannot take a break because it... So, I mean, it's a little different because the immigrant trauma is, like, a different thing. But there's overlap, I think. And I think it's definitely, like, cultural. Because, yeah, I see it a lot in my family, despite being a citizen.
Yeah. And I think you touched on something that, just being immigrant. But, like, inequalities, like, on workplace, sometimes it has to be due to gender, sometimes it has to be due to, I don't know, like, color or race or, I think, how do you think that we, in our line of work, in advocacy, I think we might say, like, working for a nonprofit, we might say, like, okay, they advocate for all these things, but sometimes that can also exist within, like those inequalities can also exist within our workplace. So how can we navigate that?
That's also a really good question. I don't even know how to answer that. I think all you can do, I mean, navigate it as like an employee or like advocating or like more like in general.
I think just like as we were talking about advocating for ourselves, how can we continue doing that and advocating on our own workplace?
So, yeah, that's hard because you're employed. So it's like you don't want to cross anybody. But I think it's super important to be able to stand up for people in your workplace that, you know, may mm-hmm. not be comfortable standing up for themselves. Mm-hmm. Or whether they are comfortable or not, even if they are, maybe they advocate for themselves all the time, then back them up. You know, I think having that sense of community within your own workplace mm-hmm. is super important because you're not always going to have a great boss or great employers. Or even if you do, like, they're not always going to have great policies. And so it's not only about advocating for yourself, but the work we do is about advocating for your community. That includes mm-hmm. your fellow colleagues. I know I work with people that are definitely, like, more shy or more soft-spoken than I am. And I'm pretty quiet. But, like, so you can imagine, like, they're definitely more timid than I am. And you see, like, you know, things that make them uncomfortable, and they're not going to fight for themselves. They're never going to tell their boss. They're never going to tell their coworkers. They're never going to do anything about it. So then I think if you can, if you're in the position to do it, you should maybe find a way to tactfully bring up, you know, that scenario to whoever's in charge or just draw attention to it to maybe the group so that everybody's aware. And you don't have to single anybody out. If you have a shy friend, you don't want to, like, mm-hmm. be like, hey, you know, so-and-so is upset because you did this. Like, you don't have to do it like that. You can be more subtle about it. But I think it's important to find ways to support each other, advocate mm-hmm. for each other, even when no one is watching.
I agree with you. I will say the key word again is community. Like, we watch for ourselves, we advocate for ourselves, but also for our community. Even if, like, there's, like, differences, or even if it's not, like, the same issues that you care about, like, maybe, like, some people care more about climate justice, or I care more about immigration, or but still advocate for each other regardless of different lines or different passions that we have. And I think, like, just for to conclude, I would say, what would you like, or what do you hope to see yourself, like, in the future? Like, what do you see yourself doing, like, continuing advocating? How do you see yourself in the advocating community?
I'm not sure. I'm still trying to figure that out. I'm really lucky that I have this job because it pays enough for me to be able to do what I want to do while working on the things I want to work on. But this job is also kind of funny because I got it at a really weird time. I was recently, about a year ago, I was in a really, like, brutal car accident. I fractured, like, my neck and my back, and, like, I was not supposed to live. Mm-hmm. I did. So that's cool, but this was, like, a really accessible job, like, by the time I was discharged. Mm-hmm. This was a job that was available, and I took it. And so I took it because I had already been following this organization online, Texas Rising. Like, I knew of them for a couple of years. I think I had, like, followed them on Instagram. So I knew of them, and I think it was just kind of by chance. Like, one time I was just like, I wonder if they're hiring. And I went online, and I looked at their website. I went to the El Paso chapter, and for some reason, like, at that moment, there was a field organizer position open. Mm-hmm. So I applied, and I got it, like, a few weeks later. So I'm just really lucky that it panned out that way. But I don't know where to go from here. That's something that I've been trying to figure out. I was never, so, like, the advocacy, that's always something that was important to me, but I never imagined making a career out of it. But now I'm here. So I'm not sure where I'm going to go with it, but whether or not I make a career out of it, advocacy and organizing is something I feel like I would have to do for the rest of my life.
that's okay. And I think that's what I was going to say. And to conclude, I could do this for free.
Yeah,
even though
exactly.
We're talking about it, I could continue doing this for me, for my community, for my friends, for my family. Yeah. And I think that will go on both of us. But thank you, Sophia.
Thank you, Yvonne.